This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
In early September, the for-profit college, ITT Tech, suddenly shut down operations, and over 50,000 students were left with no degree, lots of debt, and few options.
I want to focus squarely on what we here at the department and what others around the country are doing to support the thousands of students affected by ITT's closure.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear from the Undersecretary of Education about what's being done to help the displaced students of ITT Tech. We'll also talk to the author of a book on evolution that's aimed at a very specific age group, preschoolers. And we'll spend an academic minute with what could be called the opposite of evolution, extinction. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. ITT Technical Institute, which we will from now on call ITT Tech, was a for-profit technical institute with over 120 campuses in 38 states. In August, the company was barred from enrolling new students who use government loans and chose to stop enrolling any new students at all. Then on September 6th, ITT Tech announced that it was immediately ceasing operations and closed all of its campuses. 10 days later, it filed for bankruptcy. Here is Ted Mitchell, U.S. Undersecretary of Education.
The landscape for students of ITT Tech has changed dramatically. It's been just 2 weeks since students were informed that the school would be closing its doors. Many students were surprised, troubled, and upset, all of which is understandable. To go back a bit, as I've said before, we took a series of financial oversight measures following a set of troubling findings made by the school's accreditor, the Accrediting Council for Independent Colleges and Schools, ACICS. ACICS determined that ITT, and I'm quoting here, is not in compliance and is unlikely to become in compliance with ACICS accreditation criteria, end quote. We determined that it would be risky, indeed irresponsible, to allow the school to continue participating in our federal aid program without enhanced oversights. In June, and then again in August, we increased our oversight of the institution, oversight that goes back to 2014 when we placed ITT on heightened cash monitoring status.
In a conference call on September 19th, Undersecretary Mitchell talked about what the future may hold for some ITT Tech students.
Today, I want to focus squarely on what we here at the department and what others around the country are doing to support the thousands of students affected by ITT's closure. Shortly after the closure was announced, we sent out an email to all enrolled students at ITT Tech and informed them of their options, either to pursue a closed school federal loan discharge or to work to transfer their earned credits and continue their studies elsewhere.
That's a pretty important choice. If a student chooses a closed school federal loan discharge, the student has no debt. This is for direct federal loans, federal Family Education Loan Program loans, or federal Perkins loans, not private student loans. However, if a student takes that option, they lose the college credits they've accumulated. If students choose to transfer their credits, well, they are still responsible for the full amount of whatever outstanding loans they might have. Undersecretary Mitchell says the Department of Education has been reaching out to many students since the school shut down.
I want to list just a few of the ways in which we've been in touch with students since that initial email. First, we equipped a team of federal financial aid professionals to answer thousands of calls and emails we knew that we would receive. Second, we built a resource page on our student aid website with frequently asked questions, closed school loan discharge guidance, and a schedule of online and in-person events. And we are routinely updating that page with new resources every day. Third, we organized interactive webinars for students and worked with colleges and state authorizing agencies around the country to host in-person transfer fairs. Through these efforts, we've had almost 22,000 interactions with impacted students in just these 2 weeks. And we didn't stop there. We also sought the help of our federal agency partners, especially the Departments of Veterans Affairs, Defense, and Labor, to help build awareness of options and resources for students. Their support has been invaluable. For example, representatives from the VA joined our webinars to answer questions unique to veterans and to service members impacted by the closure. And the Department of Labor will provide information to its network of nearly 2,500 American job centers about options available to former students impacted by ITT's closures. Additionally, employees displaced by school closings can access reemployment assistance through the American Job Centers and the services they provide.
For students who want to continue their education, Mitchell says the department has reached out across the country to community colleges.
On the day of ITT's closure, I sent a letter to community college presidents and system leaders around the country, encouraging them to take an active role in engaging students interested in continuing their education. Many institutions around the country are opening their doors to former ITT students and are helping them to identify programs that match their interest and will allow them to continue their educational pursuits. Many have launched their own resource pages, inviting former ITT students to information sessions and to meet with campus representatives. Some colleges will consider direct credit transfers, while others will rely on prior learning assessments or credit by exam. States are also stepping up. State attorneys general are helping us think through how best to engage with students, and they have offered to assist students with pursuing federal loan discharge and exploring other options to continue their own education.
Undersecretary of Education Ted Mitchell says it's not just his department coming to the aid of former ITT Tech students.
A number of accreditors, higher education associations, community college associations, counseling networks, and student advocacy organizations are galvanizing support and inciting action among their members, all in an effort to support affected students. For example, several accreditors, including SACS in the Southern region and both California regional accreditors, a higher learning commission in the middle of the country, along with ACCSC, a large national accreditor, have encouraged their colleges to consider welcoming ITT students. These accreditors have proactively provided clear guidance to ensure colleges know how they can support ITT students, including guidance on the transfer of credit, prior learning assessment, and the ability for colleges to waive limits on the number of credits that can be transferred from one institution to another. I want to emphasize one point that the accreditors have made, and this is something that we want colleges and universities around the country to hear clearly. The source of accreditation, meaning the accreditor, is not alone enough to negate the possibility of transferring credit. We understand that colleges will look at credits in a sophisticated and sensitive way, and we appreciate their attention to ITT students.
Also giving attention to those students is a company called Beyond 12. They have teamed up with the National Association of Student Financial Aid Administrators, NAFSA, to develop an online platform to help match students displaced by school closures with counselors who can provide critical financial aid and academic guidance at no cost to students. Alexandra Bernadotte is the founder and CEO of Beyond 12. She says the need for ITT Tech students is deep and immediate.
Many of our students and the students that we will be serving are among the most vulnerable seeking higher education, and without capable and targeted help, they face the prospect of debt without a degree. A little bit about our background and the work that we're doing. Beyond 12 is a national technology-based service organization, and our mission is to significantly increase the number of students from underserved communities who earn a post-secondary degree. With a network of K-12 college and nonprofit partners, we're currently tracking the post-secondary progress of more than 40,000 students, and we are coaching and advising nearly 2,000 students nationally on 180 different college campuses. We are pleased to put our work and our experience in tracking students' progress and providing individualized coaching and advising support through phone, text, and email to help ITT students and to help other students continue and complete college. We have the experience, and we're used to guiding students with the least experience and networks to succeed in higher education. And that is the foundation of the work that we do and why we are pleased to join the department in ASPA in providing this much-needed resource to ITT students.
Bernadotte says the program they put together is called Next Steps EDU.
Through the Next Steps EDU website, we are connecting students displaced by school closures with volunteers who are knowledgeable about financial aid via a user-friendly online help ticket system. So students will navigate to the website, and once they complete a ticket and they give us information about the kind of challenge that they're experiencing and the kind of help that they would like from us, we route those tickets to qualified advisors who will respond to their questions via email, phone, or text messaging. We are providing our own cadre of advisors to help support this effort, and our advisors will be focused on providing students with academic resource navigation, and we are pleased to partner with NASPA, and they will be taking on the Herculean effort of providing students with information about financial aid. So their network of 20,000 financial aid professionals at 2,500 colleges and universities across the country will be volunteering to help students make important decisions about student aid, debt, and loan options.
The organizations hope their efforts will keep students in school and get value for their work. ITT Tech has been the subject of many issues and investigations over the years. Tom Miller is the Attorney General of the state of Iowa. He says they have only themselves to blame.
The problems that ITT was dealing with were created by ITT over a period of time and were significant problems. They had a chance to deal with those problems and correct them. They did not. They had a chance to do one or more mergers that would have solved the problem. They did not. So this was very fair and very important. It sends a powerful message to this sector.
Students looking to take advantage of the new program from Beyond 12 and NAFSA can go to the website nextsteps.edu. Still to come, a new book teaches the theory of evolution to readers who may just about be out of diapers. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. When you think of picture books for preschoolers, you usually think of simple topics like bedtime or playing in the park. On the other hand, in his new book, Jonathan Tweet introduces toddlers to the concept of evolution. The book is called Grandmother Fish, A Child's First Book of Evolution, and it uses simple language and colorful illustrations to explain a concept to children that, well, frankly, many adults are still having trouble with. I spoke to Jonathan Tweet about his book and asked why this topic to this age group.
Yeah, I'm surprised that people ask me that question. Maybe I come from a different background, but for me, when I had a little girl, when my daughter was little, it seemed obvious that we would want a storybook to teach very young children where we came from. And I'm surprised to see how little is already out there. And so I'm happy to have done a book that apparently nobody else ever wanted to tackle, which is, you know, make evolution not only accessible to little kids, but adorable and attractive.
Did you consult with anybody about how to word certain things?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I worked on this for years and years. You know, I ran it by friends. I'm a game designer, so I've got a lot of creative friends. I had a friend who was in children's books, and she looked at it. That was years ago. She told me it was not really ready for prime time. So I kept working on it and working on it. I got a lot of feedback. And then back in 2014, I finally figured out how to do the book right. And then when I went to self-publish it again, I got all sorts of feedback from friends who are writers or children's authors, and I got feedback from little kids. I got feedback from friends. And the great thing about doing a project on Kickstarter where you're self-publishing it is that it's this interesting quest and people want to help you. Not to mention Eric Mickle from the National Center for Science Education. He went through the book line by line with me to make sure that all the science is in line with, you know, what we know about evolution. So, yeah, I never could have done any of this without this help. And, in fact, even my artist, Karen Lewis, she is a children's science illustrator. She has way more experience in kids' books than I do, and she was a lot more than an illustrator for me, too. She helped me with the story, and she really helped bring out sort of the cute and lovable side of evolution.
It's almost like it's a couple of separate books, because in the back you have a section for adults and how to talk to kids about this. Which part was more difficult to write?
For sure, the kids' part was the more difficult to write. The kids' part took 15 years, and the part in the back I did in a couple months. The material in the back explains evolution to grown-ups in such a way that they can answer questions for kids or, you know, take kids to the next level. And then, honestly, for a lot of grown-ups, it's also a refresher course or things they've never learned before. And so that was my opportunity. I'm a big science geek, and that back matter was an opportunity for me to really geek out on evolution and get into all sorts of details and explain how I created the book the way that I did. But the first part, you know, how do you explain something as vast and surprising as evolution? How do you explain that to little minds? That took, you know, forever.
I'm glad you talked about the illustrations. The illustrations are just magnificent in the book. That was, was that a collaborative process, or did you say, okay, start drawing?
That was very much a collaborative process. Finding Karen was just one of the big strokes of luck in this whole endeavor. You know, I had guidelines for what I expected to see illustrated on every page, and then Karen took it to the next level. As a children's science illustrator, Karen is able to take, you know, references from a science book and turn them into an illustration that scientists can recognize but that children also love. And that combination, that ability to be scientifically accurate and appealing, you don't find that everywhere. But in addition to the illustrations, she helped bring out sort of the family aspect of the story. You know, I asked her to draw Grandmother Ape. She drew Grandmother Ape plus a little baby ape. That makes the scene a lot cuter and a lot more appealing to kids, especially when a kid is having the story read to them by a grown-up, and then they see a grown-up ape with a baby ape. It's very touching. We really took that and ran with it, and like we even added eggs to the illustration of Grandmother Reptile so that the sort of the family theme would get carried through. And I think that's part of the appeal. Kids love families. They sort of have an intuitive sense for understanding families, and they get the whole grandmother thing pretty well. And kids love animals. And the story of evolution is how we're all part of the big animal family. So it turns out kids just really respond to that.
Well, I went to school at a time when, you know, you were taught evolution in science classes. It's not that cut and dried now. It's actually become a pretty controversial topic in some places. Have you gotten any feedback about that?
Well, for sure, you know, the creationists do not want me to have written this book, right? They're not happy about it. And Ken Ham, you know, he's the guy with the Ark Encounter. He blogged about how terrible it was that I was doing this book. But, you know, they're welcome to their opinion. I haven't gotten any real pushback. There was a publisher who was considering taking up the book 2 years ago and did not. And part of the reason was they thought that schools would not be interested in it, that it was teaching evolution at too young an age. That's not exactly controversy, but for sure I did run into people who thought there's no way you can really teach kids about our origins if they're 3 years old.
Well, the Kickstarter campaign kind of worked out well for you, so you got some good feedback beforehand. How about now? Now that the book is out, what are you hearing?
Well, you know, I hear from parents all the time because I'm on Facebook and Twitter and what have you as Grandmother Fish. I get lots of great photos of kids with the books. Lots of parents tell me it's the kids' new favorite book. They want it read to them every night. One blogger said, you know, he's had the book for a year now because he got my self-published edition a year ago, and his son still likes it. So I hear a lot of anecdotal evidence that's great. School Library Journal, you know, they're a pretty prestigious journal, and they call the book groundbreaking in their review. So that's really nice to see that, you know, after all these years of me working away at this book and hoping that it would really find an audience and really strike a chord, now there are people who are really recognizing it on a larger scale than ever.
Well, what's next? Is there anything you can do for a sequel?
It's really hard to do a sequel. You know, I worked on this book for 15 years. I can't come around and duplicate that effort. But there is a really interesting thing that Karen and I are doing next. So on October 17th, we're going to launch another Kickstarter like we did 2 years ago. Again, it's going to feature her art, and it's going to be something for kids and grown-ups both that deals with evolution, but it's a card game called Clades. It's actually a game that I came up with. It's based on evolutionary themes, and it's based on the research that I did to do grandmother fish. I learned a lot about evolution in this process. And so the clades game is an animal matching game that uses evolutionary relationships or branches of the evolutionary tree as one of the matching features. So all the cards have pictures of different animals and groups of animals that are related evolutionarily. And the word clade, it's a really important fundamental concept in biology, which is it's a complete branch of the evolutionary family tree. So it's an ancestral population and all the populations that have ever descended from it. That forms a clade. So that's a really important concept. It's one that, you know, I studied biology in college and I never got that concept. Here again, I'm trying to take this sort of big idea and boil it down to something that kids can get excited about it. And I'm a game designer by profession, and so it's sort of natural for me to do an evolution game.
Again, the name of Jonathan Tweet's book is Grandmother Fish, A Child's First Book of Evolution. It's published by Macmillan Children's Publishing Group. So if you don't evolve, you go extinct. Okay, that could be the start of a long argument, but mass extinctions don't usually happen all at once. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Extinction doesn't always happen in the blink of an eye. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Charles Mitchell, professor in the geology department at the University at Buffalo, discusses how nature usually takes a slower course to the same goal.
We tend to think of mass extinctions as sudden events. An asteroid strikes and the dinosaurs are gone. The end of an era has arrived. But in other cases, there may be warning signs. With colleagues, I did a study that teased apart what happened to marine communities in the run-up to Earth's first mass extinction about 445 million years ago. We looked at nearly 22,000 fossils to reach our conclusions. We focused on planktonic animals called graptolites, and what we saw is that their communities started changing long before the mass extinction. The communities decreased in diversity and complexity. At first, the communities included a diverse mix of shallow water and deep water species, but over time, shallow water species started to dominate, and the deep water organisms became rare. These shifts began as much as 400,000 years before the mass extinction. They happened at a time when the Earth's climate was transitioning from a warm era to a cooler one. This change in climate drastically altered the currents and nutrient supplies in the oceans. As we face climate change again today, our research holds a cautionary tale. It suggests that ecosystems often respond in stepwise and mostly predictable ways to changes in the physical environment until they can't. Then we reach a tipping point at which dramatic declines in populations ensue. The question for today is whether a similar tipping point lies ahead. We see radical transformations underway in many of Earth's ecosystems, including the oceans. Are these the warning signs of a much larger event to come? With all the changes afoot, we need to be quite concerned about where our ocean communities may be headed.
That was Chuck Mitchell of the University at Buffalo. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other national productions or WAMC podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.